Welcome to Cedar Creek. Glad to see you all here this morning. And if you are out in the lobby, we would love it if you'd come on in and join us. We are finishing up this four-week series we've been doing on what we've called Tough Topics, Challenging Assumptions. And this has been a fun series, a challenging series, an interesting series for us to be going through. If you haven't been with us through this, we the first week did the question of whether there are multiple ways to God. The second week we looked at questions of abortion. Last week we talked about what does the Bible say about hell and judgment. And if you didn't listen to those, they are available on our website. You can go back and listen to them. Actually, we have it now where you can listen to both the Friday night teaching and the Sunday morning teaching, which are sometimes done by different men. And so you'll hear the same general theme, but it may be colored just a little bit differently depending on which person is teaching. This morning, we're going to be finishing up this series by looking at the question of gender and sexuality. And I did the teaching on hell and judgment last week. This teaching on gender and sexuality is harder for, or was harder for me to put together than the one on hell and judgment. Partly because it's such a huge topic, both biblically and culturally, but also because this is a real hot button issue. If you look both in and outside of the church. So I'll try and do biblical justice to this. Parents, I will warn you, this is probably PG-13 type of teaching today. We will have that, keep that in mind as we're going through and kind of talking. What I'd like to do is start us in prayer, and then we'll kind of jump right into the topic. Father, thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for this place where we can congregate and talk about your word, that you give us minds to think through challenging topics, that we would be able to try and discern, God, what you tell us. I pray that you would give me boldness today and humility as I try and explain what I see in your word. And I would just pray that you would give open ears and open hearts as we talk about this challenging thing. Pray this in your name. Amen. So the plan is, we're going to talk about Made This Way, gender and sexuality this morning. And kind of the plan for how I want to do this is I want to talk a little bit first about what is gender sexuality, particularly as it's identified or defined within the culture in which we live. And then I want to move on to thinking through how do we give a biblical view on this? How do we think up a biblical worldview on, again, questions of gender and sexuality? You're going to see that they are in many ways quite different from one another. And so what I want you to do is just pay attention as we're going through these things and really seek to have a heart that's turned to the gospel in this as we walk through. Now, one of the things that we that I would say before we even jump off here is that when we come to questions, these tough topics, to a lot of things, we jump off from the perspective of identity. So we begin from a place where we're asking the question, who am I? And that applies here. We operate from this from the perspective, from the stage, from the worldview of who am I as a person? Every person in this world asks this question, who am I? Right? And there's a lot of different ways we answer that question. You know, as I was thinking about this teaching, I was thinking about what are things that define me? So, I am a man. That's part of what makes up my identity. I am a husband. I am a father. I am a neuropsychologist. I am a Christian. There's lots of things that factor into who I am. For me, as a believer, the Christian piece, the piece that I'm tied to God, is the kind of core of the identity. It colors everything else about all the other things about who I am. Okay? And so everybody asks those questions. What I would say is, in a culture like we have, that is, if we're quite honest, quite sex-driven, in a culture that idolizes sex, in a culture where it's saturated, where sex is everywhere, that becomes foundational, very core to the way a lot of people will identify themselves. So it's not just who am I, but who am I as a sexual being that begins to define the core of a person's identity. And so we wrestle with, who am I? And Matt Novacek, who taught on Friday night, made the point that it really comes down to two options: who am I as a believer versus who am I in the world? So keep that in mind as we're talking through this. I want to tell you a little bit, how does society define gender? If you have spent any time looking over the news, if you spend time reading, if you spend time just even looking around you, the word gender is popping up a lot more than it used to. We see this showing up more and more often. So I thought I would start us with a dictionary definition of gender. So there's two pieces to this. The first one there, this is from the dictionary, says, gender is male or female as defined by social and cultural roles and behavior. So, according to the dictionary, a person is either male or female, not based on their biology, but based upon the roles that they assume, the behaviors that they act out in society and in culture. As you can see, those things may not necessarily be the same thing. The second piece, I would say, is probably a newer addition to the dictionary definition, and it says a similar class of individuals outside of binary identification. So binary identification means there's two possible options, right? Male, female are the two possible options. So gender can also be defined outside of that. So a person may not be male or female. It could be some other sort of thing. So keep that in mind. That's a lot of times how we're thinking of gender as we look at the culture around us. These are the thoughts that are forming how people think about gender. Now, what I would say is that gender, and even by extension sexuality, in our culture are largely self-identified. They are largely self-pursued. I said last week we were talking about relativism. Relativism is the idea that truth is subjective, that I can identify for myself what is true. So I can say it is true that I am a woman. I can say it is true that there are many ways to God. And however I define truth for myself becomes true. Now, in relativism, there can be a whole bunch of different truths. People can believe lots of different things. In fact, each individual can have their own makeup of what is true. And we are to tolerate one another's viewpoints on that. So as you can see, we see this with gender where it becomes self-identified. A person can determine who they are as a gendered person. They can also self-identify what is true about sexuality. So however I want to express myself as a sexual being is okay and is true. That happens in a relativistic culture. So again, it comes down to this question of identity: who am I? I think they're knocking down the walls of Jericho next door. So at least I heard that was what was going on today. So it comes down to who am I? When we take these core things about our identity and begin to look at them, we understand that this is the lens that kind of filters how I begin to view the world. So when I think of myself as a sexual being, or I think of myself as someone who is biologically male, but gendered female, I begin to look at things in a little bit different viewpoint. It clouds, it affects how I think of things, just as being a Christian affects how we look at the world. But there are effects of this as well. And these are wide-ranging, very broad effects within our world. We live in a world where this, what I would say, broken sexuality affects, again, a lot of stuff. If you look around us, we see the fingers of this on almost everything in the culture that's around us. We live in a culture that idolizes sex. And we see this in issues of sexual brokenness. Romans 1:24, I was actually going to go through all of Romans 1 today, which is a very good passage if you're wondering what the Bible says about sexuality and broken sexuality. But I'm going to hit this one here, this Romans 1:24. And it says, "Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the creator." So a lot of stuff that we see when it comes down to broken sexuality comes from a place where God has given them up to lust and impurity because they have denied God. We said last week that people suppress the truth in unrighteousness. That actually comes from this Romans 1 passage as well. They dishonor them bodies. They dishonor their bodies. So sexual brokenness, sexual immorality comes from a place of dishonoring of the body. Specifically, how do we see this showing up? Pornography. We've talked about this in here before. I would note to you that the word pornography, if you break it down to its Greek roots, the word graphe means writing. The word porneia in the Bible means sexual immorality. So when you see pornography, it means writings about sexual immorality. Okay? So when you see that word, that's what should trigger in your mind. This is something that has become just so pervasive in our culture, right? Videos, books, movies, everywhere we see the influences of porneia, of sexual immorality in our culture. I like to talk about statistics with this because I think it's beneficial for us to get a viewpoint on this. I pulled these from a website called Triple X Church, which you'd think I shouldn't look at that website, but it's actually about how sexual immorality affects the church. And a couple of things that they point out, 40 million American adults regularly look at pornography. 40 million American adults regularly look at pornography. Not just a one-time thing, they do it regularly. Pornography is a bigger industry than National Football League. The National Basketball Association, Major League Baseball, hockey. It makes more money than any of those do. The majority of the top websites are pornography driven. Listen to this, parents. 90% of 8 to 16 year olds have seen pornography online. 8 to 16-year-olds. My daughter Tessa, who most of you know, turns 8 next week. 90%, 9 out of 10 who are 8 to 16 have seen pornography online. 1 in 4 teenagers have sent pictures of themselves or someone that they know to another person or have received those naked pictures of somebody. The links here to things that we speak out against are pretty prominent. So the link between pornography and human trafficking, which we talk a lot about, is pretty profound. The link to sexual assault, right? 1 in 4 girls, 1 in 4 women have been sexually assaulted. There's a link here to pornography. Erectile dysfunction, very common in 20-year-olds nowadays because of this. The link to abortion, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, very strong. If you claim to be against abortion, you cannot be pro-pornography. Adultery. Second thing, we see the sexual, the brokenness, sexual brokenness through adultery. So having sex with someone other than your spouse. The Bible talks a lot about adultery. In fact, one of the statistics I found said that 28% of men, 15% of women have confessed to having had adulterous relationships, either physically or emotionally, with someone else. So 1 in 4 men, 1 in 6 women. Sex outside of marriage. So even if you're not married, sex outside of marriage, pretty common. By age 20, 75% of people have had sex with someone who is not a spouse. 75%, 3 in 4. By age 44, according to WebMD, 95% of people have had sex with someone who is not their spouse. We live in a culture that you don't even have to be in a committed romantic relationship to have sex with someone else. Many of you might have heard the term hookup culture or friends with benefits. You have somebody with whom you have a merely physical relationship with no romantic or relational connection. It's not good for us. We see it in all sorts of different ways this appears in our world. We see it with people who are engaging outside of the biblical mandate for man and woman. So we see homosexual sex happening in our culture. We see lots of different expressions of this that I'm not going to spend a lot of time going into because I want to keep it PG-13 and not R. Every perversion you can imagine can be found in 30 seconds or less on the internet. Guarantee it. So we see this stuff happening, and we see this in a society that idolizes sex, in a society that says that sex is the ultimate attainment. It becomes the core of who we are. Right? We see this also with questions of gender identity, or what I might say is gender confusion. When I was young, at least as far as I remember, there were male and there were female, and they matched up with one's biological sex. That's not the case anymore. You probably have heard the term transgender. Basically, again, I'm biologically one way, I identify in another direction. At one point, Matt and I both stumbled across the same statistic. The social media platform Facebook had 58 different gender options you could choose from. I can't even imagine what those 58 things are. Now, it's changed so that they have a custom box. You can kind of fill in whatever it is that you want, gender-wise. We see this, you've seen it pop up in the news with things like bathroom laws. Who's allowed to use the men's room? Who's allowed to use the women's room? And it's created all sorts of controversy. I think the one that I think struck me the most was an athlete that I idolized when I was little, somebody named Bruce Jenner, was on the Wheaties box, Olympic decathlete, defined manhood, right? He's now come out as Caitlyn Jenner and identifies now as a woman. He was actually on the cover, I think, of Vanity Fair magazine as their Woman of the Year, I think. So we see that happening. So there's sexual brokenness, there's gender confusion. There's also a failure to live into our gender roles. See this in a couple of ways, and I'm going to circle back to this here in a little bit. But first, in terms of men, I would say men tend to withdraw. Men don't engage with their worlds. In Genesis 3:6, it's the story of the fall. The serpent is tempting Eve, and she eats of the fruit. Adam doesn't speak up, right? He is failing to move into her world. He is failing to speak out. There's an old word called acedia, which kind of means apathy. And so what happens too often in broken relational roles is men disengage. They don't show up. So they get done with work, they come home, plop on the couch, watch TV for the rest of the night until they go to bed. They don't engage in their worlds. They don't engage in their families. They don't engage with their kids. They don't engage in the church. But it's not just men. Women have this as well. We see with women a tendency more to assume what might traditionally be men's roles. Genesis 3:16, just a few verses down, I love how the NLT puts it. It says, "Your desire shall be to control your husband, but he will rule over you." So God is telling Eve, one of the consequences of the fall is you're going to want to control your husband. We see this later in Proverbs, actually four different times in Proverbs. You come across this word, contentious and vexing. It talks about a contentious and vexing wife. Solomon, King Solomon, wrote much of the book of Proverbs, and he, again and again, said this idea that he talked about a contentious and vexing woman. One of the ways he puts it, he says, you know what, it is better to live in the corner of your rooftop than to live with a contentious and vexing wife. And I wonder, Solomon had 600 wives. And so I wonder, was it just one of them that he found to be contentious and vexing? What was going on for him that he kept coming back to this theme? Contentious means argumentative, right? I'm going to push you and push you and push you and push you in an argumentative way. Vexing is somebody who kind of creates irritability, somebody who makes the man go, ugh! It speaks about that, right? A desire to control your husband. So there's a failure to live into those gender roles. I would say that a lot of the struggle that we see in the world around us has to do with relational and, by extension, with sexual struggles that we come across. None of us are exempt from this. So that's what the effects are when we see kind of a worldly viewpoint of gender and sexuality. But if we want to live biblically, how do we live? What does that look like to want to live in a biblically informed way? For those of us who are believers and say we want to conform ourselves to the word of Christ, what does that look like in our lives? The first thing is that we practice sexual purity. Right? We live in a world that sexual purity is not something we see around us. In fact, sex outside of marriage is not just common but often expected. How do we push back against that? Should we push back against that? Maybe those are the questions we need to ask. And I want to read a section here from 1 Thessalonians 4. I'm going to start at verse 3. And it says, "For this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality, that each one of you know how to control his own body in holiness and honor, not in the passion of lust like the Gentiles who do not know God, that no one transgresses and wrong his brother in this matter, because the Lord is an avenger in all these things, as we told you beforehand and solemnly warned you. For God has not called us for impurity, but in holiness." So, what does that say? God's desire for us is sanctification. In other words, to grow to be more and more like Jesus. How does that show up? By not engaging in sexual immorality. That is a different message than you get from culture. So that's one way. And what I would say with that, this stuff is going on in every church in town, including this one. There's stuff people are afraid to talk about. There's stuff that brings a lot of shame, and people don't want to say what it is that they're struggling with. Find someone you can talk to. Please make sure it's somebody who is the same sex as you are. I have a couple of guys that I've been meeting with for 7 years, and we have complete freedom to speak into one another's lives. My wife was gone earlier this week, and I emailed Brad and Eric, and I said, guys, Heather is gone. My thoughts are going where I don't want them to. Please pray for me. Because then I knew that in a couple days, they would say, how are you doing? Find someone you can bring these struggles to. Find someone you can confess these things to. Don't try to do this on your own. So in addition to sexual purity, what about seeking to live into what the Bible says about gender? How do we live as gendered image bearers? First, I would say that we were created gendered. In Genesis 1:27, it says we were created male and female. Actually, it says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So there is a recognition that this was part of God's original design, right? There's a difference between men and women. As I was getting ready for this, I was thinking, okay, God said that he needed a helper, or said that Adam needed a helper, and so makes another person. Why didn't God just make another man? He could have, right? I mean, there was nothing to say that in order for the growth of the human species that there had to be a man and a woman. God very easily could have created a way where it's just men that were created. But he didn't. Why not? I think it's because God had a clear image, a clear intentional image that there's something unique, something beautiful about men and about women in their uniqueness. In fact, after God created both Adam and Eve, he said, "This is very good." Right? He called our genderedness very good. I love in Genesis 2 when Adam first sees Eve after she's been created. What does he say? He's like, at last. There's clearly a, he sees her and he's like, yes, that is what I've been looking for. There's a genderedness that comes with that. And this is reflected also in our biology, right? This isn't just some biblical principle. This is reflected in our biology. A couple months ago, I finished work on a book chapter with a theologian from Southern Baptist Seminary, and it's for a book on marriage, but our chapter was on the biology of men and women. It was on, it was called Wired for Relationships, and so we looked at these questions about what's unique about men, what's unique about women from a biological perspective. And it's not just anatomical. I can, you know, all of us can look and say, oh yeah, anatomically, I can tell who a man and a woman is. But genetically, we're different from one another. The way our brains are wired are different between men and women. Hormonally, there's a difference between men and women. Men have more testosterone. Women have more progesterone and estrogen. It's how we're created. Some interesting stuff. If you look after they marry, men's testosterone drops and women's increases. Helps foster connection. We're designed this way, right? So we're created gendered. So what is that, when we talk about this, what does it look like to be a gendered image bearer? So let's talk with a biblical masculinity. Just I want to say, first off, biblical masculinity is not the ability to fix cars, hunt well, grow big muscles, sexual prowess. None of these things define biblical masculinity. We're going to actually take a look at Paul's letter to the Ephesians. The end of the book there, in chapter 5, there's some instruction that are given to husbands. And men, this applies to us. I'm going to start at verse 25. It says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. So there's a few things as we look through biblical masculinity, a few ideas that are going to pop out to us. The first one is that men, we are called to protect. If you remember earlier, I said that one of the sins of manhood is that we don't show up. We're apathetic. We engage in acedia, if you remember that word. Right? We need to show up and be present, men. Genesis 3, I started talking about this earlier. So in Genesis 3, story of Eve and the serpent, right? So the serpent says to Eve, he says, "Did God really say to you that you shouldn't eat this fruit of this tree?" And Eve says, "Well, he said we shouldn't eat it or touch it or we would die." Do you know that when God said that, he didn't tell Eve that? Eve wasn't even created when God said that. He gave that to Adam. Adam then said it to Eve, is our presumption. But the piece here, men, listen. The piece here that I want you to hear is it says she ate of the fruit and she gave some to her husband who was with her. So Adam was right there while all this was going on. Why the heck did Adam not step up and protect his wife? He knew what God had said. Why didn't he show up? He just sat back and did nothing. We got to protect men. We need to move into situations, right? We need to be there physically. We need to be there relationally. We need to be there emotionally. Broken men withdraw to what is safe and comfortable. We're afraid to move into the mystery. We are afraid to move into hard circumstances. Men, show up. The second piece of that is that we serve. How do men serve? Again, we serve by showing up. In Genesis 1:27, the word that's used for male there is the word zakar. The word zakar is also used later in Exodus 2:24 to describe God. Specifically, it says, God remembered his covenant with his people. So the word zakar means remember. So as men, we are the remembering ones. One of the ways we best serve people is by remembering what God has said and reminding people of that. Right? We serve by remembering what God said, moving into the confusion by word and by action. Stop shrinking back. We're called to love like Christ loved the church. You know, one of the things that is a struggle for people is Ephesians 5 says a couple of things. It says, wives, submit to your husbands. Men, love your wives like Christ loved the church. That's a high calling. It's a high calling for women, but that's a high calling for men. I'm not good at always loving like Christ loved the church. What does that look like? We show up and be present. Christ did that for the church first through the incarnation. He came and was here on earth because we needed him to be. And then while he was here, he moved into the worlds of people who needed him, right? He moved toward people in love. He listened to people. He told them what they needed to hear. The last piece is that Ephesians 5 talks about is the need for respect. Men are most encouraged when they are respected. My friend Larry says that the core fear of most men is a feeling of weightlessness, a feeling that we have no impact in this world, right? We don't really matter. How do you combat that? You combat that by respect. When men feel respected, they feel impactful, they feel this power to move in and be involved in their world. So that's masculinity. What does the Bible say about femininity? Proverbs 31. I'm not actually going to read through the whole thing because it's a long passage. Many of you are familiar with this. It talks about an excellent wife, and it describes a lot of pieces about what does an excellent wife look like. So if you want a picture of biblical femininity, this is as good a place as any to start. And I would point out a couple of things there. First, a biblically feminine woman is a helper. It says in verses 11 and 12 there, it says, "The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not harm all the days of his life." So when God created Eve, he said that Adam needed what? A helper. So she is someone who is working, right? Where her husband is able to trust in her. She's doing him good through her help. She's not secondary. She is a necessary picture of this gendered relationship that God created. She's also relational. It says in verse 20 that she opens her hands to the poor and reaches out her hands to the needy. So she's what? She's open-handed. She's invitational. The word nekeba comes from Genesis 1:27. That refers to female. Nekeba also tends to mean someone who is open to receive. So a biblically feminine woman is open to receive. Right? She's relational. She invites people into her world. See, hospitality with this. Certainly Proverbs 31 talks a lot about hospitality. A biblically feminine woman also nourishes. She feeds those who are in her environment, not just physically, but relationally, spiritually, emotionally. Says that she feeds, Proverbs 31 says she feeds and clothes her household. The word for feminine in that's used in Mark 10:6 or for woman is thales, which actually means a breast that's producing milk. So a woman is described as a breast that's producing milk. What's the image there? Someone who nourishes and feeds those who are in their environment. So a biblically feminine woman is someone who is a helper, who is relational, who is nourishing. There is no indication in this Proverbs 31 passage of somebody who's weak, powerless, less valuable. If you read that passage, this is a hard-working, powerful woman. Women, you are called to be powerful. It's different than what masculinity looks like, but it is no less valuable. And a biblically feminine woman is most encouraged when she is appreciated. It says in verse 29, it says, "Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all." This is a woman who is deeply appreciated by her husband. Right? The core terror of women is undesirability, that I am not wanted, I am not desired, I am not to be appreciated. Right? Appreciate the women in your life. So there's pictures of biblical femininity, biblical masculinity. And I want to just finish up by bringing us back around to, again, what does the Bible say? We wrestle with questions about what is appropriate sexually, what does the Bible say about gender, what does the Bible say about sex outside of marriage, lots and lots of different things. But we need to circle back to how do we respond to the people who are in our lives? People need Jesus, not judgment. You were here last week. One of the passages I mentioned was from 1 Corinthians 5. And Paul, quite interestingly, is talking to the church at that time about sexual immorality that's happening in the church. And Paul tells the church, he says, don't worry about judging outsiders. Leave that to God. Your job is to deal with people who are inside the church. Don't judge outsiders. Too often we do that, right? I mean, we judge outsiders. We start with judgment rather than with Jesus. Now, Romans 1 does call a lot of these sexual immoralities against God, right? That is true. But we're called to respond with Jesus. Romans 2:1 don't know if I have it written down anywhere. I'm going to look it up. Romans 2:1, which follows right on the heels of that amazing passage that deals with sexual immorality. Romans 2:1, the very next verse after that says, "Therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges, for in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things." We practice the very same things we're so quick to judge other people about. We are called, friends, to love people and tell them about Jesus. Start there. Let the Holy Spirit work on convicting their hearts as He works on convicting yours. A couple things. Romans is a great, great book for this. Romans 3:23 says that all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. That includes every person who's outside of these walls and every person that is inside of them. Every person has fallen short of God's glory. Romans 5:8, a few chapters later, what does it say? It says, all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. Who does that include? Every one of us. All have sinned and fall short of God's glory. That includes men, women, transgender, homosexual, heterosexual, Christian, non-Christian. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Five chapters later, Romans 10. Look at this. It says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Who does that include? Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Every single person, if they put their faith in God, will be saved. And then it goes on in Romans 10, it says, but how will they call on Him whom they have not believed? And how will they believe if they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? Friends, we are called to tell people about Jesus. Christ is for everyone. He will meet you right where you're at. It says that if you are struggling, He'll meet you where you're at. If you are, it says Christ died for sinners, right? While we were yet sinners, He died for us. He died for people while they're looking at pornography. He died for people while they're struggling with sexual identity. He died for people while they're committing adultery. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God meets us where we are. He doesn't expect us to get cleaned up and then come to Him. He meets us where we are. What we're going to do now is I'm going to finish up the prayer. I'm going to show a short video clip. I was reminded of this by a couple of friends of mine this morning. It's a clip from Matt Chandler, and it'll, I think, kind of drive home the point. But I'll pray. The band can come up while we're doing this. God, thank You for Your Word. Thank You that You've allowed us to wrestle with hard topics. I pray, God, that You would be present in these, that if we erred in what we said, God, that You would correct those thoughts in people's minds, God, that they would see You and Your glory in all of these things. Pray this in Your good name. Amen.